Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. People took to the streets in over 140 cities across the country over the weekend to demand justice for George Floyd and to speak out against police brutality. 140 cities. That is according to the latest count from the New York Times. Last Monday night, police arrested George Floyd after they said they got a call from an employee at a convenience store who accused Floyd of trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill. A video from a store's security tape shows George Floyd complying with officers as they arrested him. As he lay on the ground in handcuffs, Derek Chauvin, a white officer, pressed his knee onto Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, according to a criminal complaint against him. According to a New York Times analysis out today, Chauvin did not remove his knee even after Floyd lost consciousness and for a full minute after paramedics arrived. According to KARE-TV in Minneapolis, Derek Chauvin has been the subject of 13 complaints since 2003. All of them were closed without discipline. Chauvin and the other three officers were fired on Tuesday. Chauvin was arrested on Friday for third-degree murder and manslaughter. The other officers remain under investigation. On Saturday, George Floyd's brother Philonese and his nephew Brandon Williams spoke with Al Sharpton on MSNBC, and here is a clip from that interview.
They didn't care about what they wanted to do with my brother. He wasn't a person to them. He was scum. He was nothing. And I can imagine how many people they did like that. I don't need them on the streets to kill anybody else. I'm hurt. My family is hurt. His kids are hurt. They will grow up without a father. Everybody is crying and in pain right now. So if they can do anything, please arrest those other officers and give them murder one.
Let me ask you this. You, it has not been asked of you. You spoke to both President Trump and the family spoke to former Vice President Biden. What did you say to them?
I asked Vice President Biden, and I never had to beg a man before, but I asked him, could he please, please get justice for my brother? Please, because I need it. I need it. I do not want to see him on a shirt just like the other guys. Nobody deserved that. Black folks don't deserve that. We're all dying. We're all dying. Black lives matter. We need it. It's pain, and we're fueled by pain right now. And we should just be peaceful, but it's hard right now.
What was the conversation with President Trump like?
It was so fast. He didn't give me the opportunity to even speak. It was hard. I was trying to talk to him, but he just kept, like, pushing me off, like, I don't want to hear what you're talking about. And I just told him I want justice. I said that I couldn't believe that they committed a modern-day lynching in broad daylight. That's, I can't stand for that. Yeah. I can't. And it hurt me, you know? And it just, I just don't understand, man. Why we got to go through this? Why we got to have all this pain, man? I love my brother. I'm never going to see him again.
Brandon, give us a sense of what type of person George Floyd was. You knew him. The world knows him now in his death. You knew him in his life. You see your father in tears. And even with talking to the President of the United States and the candidate for office, there's no peace at all because they're, in his judgment, not been charged right, members of your family. Give us a sense. Tell the nation what kind of person George was.
He was a great person, a loving person. To know him was to love him. He just had a special way of lighting up a room. If you ever encountered him, you would just instantly gravitate to him. I don't really have a word. Today is a very emotional day for me and my family. Today makes 2 years that his mother passed, which is my grandmother, and my family's hurting, so.
And that is a clip of George Floyd's brother Philonese and his nephew Brandon Williams speaking with Al Sharpton on MSNBC. They want all of the officers to be arrested and charged with murder. Right now, Derek Chauvin is the only officer that has been arrested. He was arrested on Friday for third-degree murder and manslaughter. And we should say that according to the Mapping Police Project, Mapping People Violence, 99% of police killings from 2014 to 2019 did not result in officers being charged. So today we are going to open up the lines and get your thoughts about what you have seen over the last 4 or 5 days. What's your reaction to this massive uprising? Were you on the streets? Were you affected by this? And the big question is, where is this leading? Will this lead to systemic change? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You also can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Today, we are joined by Ian Haney Lopez, a law professor at the John Bolt Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Ian is a commentator on coded racism in U.S. politics. His most recent book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And if I can, I actually want to start with a correction, in part because the correction is important to where our society is going. Last time I spoke with you, I was a John Bolt professor, but since then there's been a sort of a recognition at the law school that Bolt, who was a figure from a century ago who funded the law school, was himself deeply involved in anti-Chinese racism in the United States. And so his name has been removed from the law school, and I'm really proud to say that I'm actually now the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Law. Earl Warren was the Supreme Court Chief Justice who unified the Supreme Court to really start the Supreme Court's civil rights revolution with the opinion in Brown versus Board of Education. So let me just issue that correction, but very much in keeping with the conversation, the persistence of racism and how we fight back and the changes that our society needs to make.
Well, this is so important to this conversation, and thank you for that correction, Ian. I was on social media over the weekend. Some Confederate statues got pulled down.
As well they should. I think that the celebration, those Confederate statues were erected as part of a revisionist history that denies the deep, brutal inhumanity of slavery, that redescribed slavery as a part of a natural order of whites over blacks, and that celebrate white supremacy through these terms that give it a gloss of culture and history and tradition, so people don't have to look squarely at the ugliness of what white supremacy really is. And I think that, you know, people like Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Project, they're so right. Advancement in the United States turns partly on us really looking history squarely in the eye and saying, there's a lot of ugliness in the past and a lot of brutality and violence rooted in dehumanizing beliefs about people. And only once we confront those beliefs can we actually build a sort of society that honors our deepest, most cherished values.
Well, and this is so important, Ian, because the few interviews that I did here over the weekend with people on the streets, I mean, they talked about so many other issues. You know, one man was yelling, "We're hungry out here." Another young man interviewed on MSNBC said, "My heart is in pain. I don't know what to do with this anger." He said, "You know, luckily I can contain it, but the kids that you're seeing right now, they're angry." He said, "I have had so many run-ins with the police for no reason. I grew up in deep poverty. And I have so much pain." And we're going to hear a clip from another protester during the show. And she said, "Where were you all when the KKK was burning us down?" So there's just so many layers to this.
There's so many layers. I think I want to, if I can come back to the video that I hope that we've all seen, as painful as it is. I think when we're watching that video of Chauvin murdering George Floyd, we've seen so many of them. And so the power of it is the sort of the cumulative impact. But there's also another quality to that video. And it's you're seeing a man die. You're seeing a knee pressed to his throat. And then you're seeing Chauvin, you're seeing a white police officer whose face and posture communicates utter indifference to the fact that he's taking somebody's life. But you're watching as people are yelling at him. People are saying, "You got to stop. You're killing this guy. You got to stop." And he's so deaf, so indifferent to the life he's taking and to the people gathering around him, calling him to recognize the depravity of his action. And I think, for me at least, and maybe for others, that's the source of this. You know, the particular pain of this moment is the way in which that video crystallizes what we mean when we say racism has dehumanized people. We're watching one person kill another person, and the person doing the murdering simply doesn't see the humanity of the person he's killing. He's just, it's like another day at the office. And I think that's like the, you know, read against the larger context, and we should talk about that, the larger context being 50 years of consistently increasing levels of armed government violence against communities of color, and also the context of the pandemic and how that's playing out in our society. But I think that there's something just so deeply heartbreaking about watching a murder play out in which the murderer is simply indifferent to the pain, the violence, the tragedy of what he's doing, and so deaf to the heartfelt pleas of people standing 10 feet from him.
We also see that he had his hand in his pocket, and more information is coming out about what exactly happened. As I said in the intro, according to the criminal complaint, Chauvin had his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. The video, according to a New York Times analysis, shows that Chauvin did not remove his knee after Mr. Floyd lost consciousness and for a full minute after the paramedics arrived at the scene.
I wonder if, in his own way, Chauvin was reacting to the people calling him to stop, but in a display of brutality and a display of, you know, sort of ego, like, I don't have to stop. You can't make me stop, right? I think that's the rage and the heartbreak and the sense of vulnerability that has happened so many times. And that is the sort of violence that people who are dark-skinned, African-Americans, but also this is happening to a lot of Latinos. Levels of police killings of Native Americans are very, very high proportionate to their population. This level of government killing of our fellow citizens is routine in the United States, and we have to look at that.
What do you make of this moment, Ian? Because as you said, we've seen these videos, we've seen uprisings, there's so many names, Oscar Grant, Freddie Gray, Philando Castile. The numbers that we're seeing this time around, I mean, I don't think we've seen this since the 60s. This is really what you study, so you would know. But over the weekend, the New York Times said 75 cities. This morning, 140 cities.
I think that we are seeing a combination of factors coming together. I think that one which we should talk about is just the levels of government violence against poor communities of color. And the reason I'm saying government violence instead of police violence is because the model of crime control has spread well beyond the police themselves. So what we've done is we've moved to a view of government in which one of the essential roles of government is controlling supposedly inherently dangerous and violent people of color. That starts with Richard Nixon and his conversations about his warnings about law and order and crime in the streets. But it has expanded since then. It has moved into the juvenile justice system, for example, which used to have this mind of truancy and getting kids to school and making sure that kids made good decisions. And now itself has moved into a school-to-prison pipeline, right? The crime control model has moved to truancy. It has moved to schools. The crime control model has moved into immigration. So now the single largest armed police force in the United States is the federal immigration police, ICE. We are now in a situation in which people of color, especially poor people of color, are confronted with armed agents of the government operating within a mindset of crime control as an aspect of their daily lives, whether it's the police on the sidewalks or the security officers in the schools or the immigration officers, the juvenile justice system. This is an incredible, intense level of pervasive government violence that is new. And I don't want to emphasize that. It's new. This is not what our country looked like in the civil rights movement. It's not what things looked like in the 1950s and the 1960s, and even the 1970s. We built this up starting in the 70s, but really accelerating in the 80s and 90s with the Nixon administration, and then also Bill Clinton's administration participated. So one context is this incredible level of daily encountered with armed agents of the state who are understanding people of color as people who need to be controlled, people who are inherently violent. And now layered on top of that, the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Layered on top of that, a global health crisis that is exposing to very high levels of death poor communities of color, exposing these same communities to very high levels of employment, and at the same time also insisting that many members of these communities are essential workers who need to keep working and need to keep exposing themselves to this health risk without proper health care or proper protective equipment or social norms. I say all of this to say I don't think that the protests, the marches, the rage and the pain that we are seeing now is going to die down anytime soon, because the gasoline, if you will, of the pandemic and the suffering and the death and the way that reveals racism and who's valued and who's not. That is only spreading now, and these sparks, these matches of police violence, they're going to continue. I am deeply worried that this is going to be a long period of violent or of social protest, social upheaval, people calling for us to care for each other, and very often being met instead by more violence from government.
I want to play a clip, Ian. Again, the cable shows were out on the streets nonstop, and it was pretty rare for them to actually interview anyone, but we were able to find this clip, and I think we're just getting this ready. Great, the clip is ready. So this clip is from CNN. A reporter, Quine Law, senior national correspondent, was out on the street in Long Beach, and she spoke with one of the lead protesters of that march. Here's that clip.
Why are you still marching?
Because I matter. My family matter. My friends and fans matter. I got nephews. I got nieces. I got sisters. I got a mama. I got a daddy. I got friends. I got peers. I got all these people standing right here. They matter. Their lives matter. Nobody gives a about us, okay? Unless we get violent. Y'all care about all the being burned down, but what about when the KKK burned our down? Where were y'all then?
There's a lot of passion.
Why were y'all complaining at then? Because they our whole nation up. They up generations of kids.
So you can hear the passion.
We are in the ground for kids.
You can hear the passion and her voice.
We stand for the people who can't speak for themselves. We stand for the ones who's been knocked down. The ones who can't stand up no more because they don't have a voice anymore. We stand for peace. We stand for equality. We stand for unity. We stand for love. No justice. No justice.
No justice. And she's the one who's been leading the chant as they march through the streets. And you can hear it.
That is a clip from CNN from the protest in Long Beach, California. Ian, I think it's so important for the media to give the microphone to people like this woman, saying, you know, nobody cares about us until or unless we get violent.
I think that's right. I think that it's so important for the media to really engage people as human beings. Mm-hmm. And to ask them, why are you here? And to try and understand their reality. And you know, for all of us to say, these are other human beings. What would it take for me to go to the streets? What would it take for what would it be like for me to experience that? What would I do if it were my family? This is the challenge. The fundamental challenge for us is to recognize our shared humanity with people who may exist from us across wide gulfs, and whatever those gulfs may be, to say, what are they undergoing, and where did that come from, and how can I help? How can I? What needs to change? You know, and I think that her voice is so important as she invokes all of the members of her family. We all want to take care of our families. We all want our families to be joyful and loved, and to have a chance to thrive and to be respected in our communities, in our societies. Why is it that is so rarely available for the poor, for communities of color, for so many different groups where we devalue their humanity? I think that's when we listen to her say, I want to take care of my family, what we're listening to is somebody saying, not just it's the racism. I really do think we need to come back to the pandemic. What we are seeing with the pandemic is that some lives matter and many don't. When we look at the pandemic response at the level of the federal government, we've seen literally trillions of dollars funneled towards Wall Street to prop up the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest slice of the American electorate. But at the same time, almost nothing has been done to truly protect working families. And now at the state level, I think we've done better. The state has tried to step in and introduce distancing norms, but the state itself is not providing the resources, cannot on its own provide the resources that would really protect people from mass unemployment, protect people who need to continue to go to work to make sure that they have the health care and the protective equipment that they need. We're really in this intense period in which the disregard that our society has developed toward the poor, toward working families, toward people of color, and to those groups, that especially as they overlap, is this overwhelming reality in people's lives. They're hungry. They're dying from the virus. They're being asked to be exposed to this illness. They're being asked to expose their families to it. And they're also being treated as if we're criminals and our lives are expendable by the armed agents of the government. This is a profound moment of crisis. It's especially acute for vulnerable communities, but it is a profound moment of crisis for our society and for our democracy, for every single one of us.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Ian Haney Lopez. Ian holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. His most recent book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. And coming up after a break, we will take your calls about the massive uprising that we are seeing across the country to demand justice for George Floyd and to speak out against police brutality and really so many other issues. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We are going to be doing shows about the mass uprising, police brutality all week. So if you have any show ideas or guest ideas, please email us yourcall@kalw.org. According to the latest count from the New York Times, people took to the streets in over 140 cities across the country. And we're talking today with Ian Haney Lopez. Ian holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. His most recent book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you just want to talk about your thoughts today, if you were at the protests, what are your thoughts on where we are right now? What will it take to see systemic change? And what would you like to see? You can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us @yourcallradio. Let's go to Thomas in San Francisco. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Actually, it's Robert, but thank you.
Oh, hi, Robert. Sorry about that.
No problem. I just wanted to point something out and two facts behind it. I think it's critical that we do not lose sight of who actually is stimulating a lot of the violence or rioting that's taking place. There are two scenarios which definitely, I'm being told that they're from outsiders who have some sort of motivation to create this. This is a playbook for right-wing radicals who have cited this as a precursor to their events. This exact same scenario. And the Koch brothers, honestly, and Mr. Trump would have no problem putting people in there, just like they have before, to help stimulate a situation in order to create a situation where it would help him in the election and their agenda. If we lose sight of that, we're going to have a big, even larger and more significant problem.
Well, thank you, Robert. Ian, what are your thoughts?
I think Robert's got a really, really important point. I want to amplify it a little bit. It should be clear that Donald Trump is trying to take advantage of these protests. But I want to emphasize that Donald Trump in some ways, or politicians like him, are at the root of the police violence itself. And here's what I mean by that. When you go back to 1968 and to Richard Nixon, what you see is a moment when the
Ian, you're sounding a little muddled. Did you move in the room? Ian, are you there?
I confess.
Oh, okay. Well, that explains it. If you can go back to where you were and then start
over. I am back where I am. How am I coming across now?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, good. So I would say, you know, Robert's making a really good point, which is to say, pay attention to who benefits from this sort of conflict. Donald Trump is clearly seeking to benefit. How is he trying to benefit? Donald Trump's basic campaign theme is that the country is locked into a racial conflict between whites and people of color, and that as the country changes demographically, as people of color gain more power, as they gain greater numbers, whites are under threat, and they need to band together. Now, he doesn't say that explicitly. He uses coded terms that allow people to deny quite that this is an open appeal to white racial solidarity. But when he says things like make America great again, and we need to use greater violence, we need to build a wall, that's his theme. He is going to try, and he is trying, he is actively seeking to put that sort of spin on the contemporary protests. I want to emphasize one additional dynamic to this, which is Donald Trump is building on a playbook that's 50 years old. It started with Richard Nixon. And it's so important to emphasize that point because we can't understand the level of police violence against communities of color. We can't understand how we imprison 10 times as many people today as we did in 1970 without looking at politicians who campaigned using messages of racial fear and then turned around and governed by increasing funding for police and for prisons. The way in which government violence is deployed today against communities of color, again, from the criminal justice system to the immigration system, is directly rooted in politicians who campaign on messages of fear and resentment and who then turn around, like Donald Trump, and mainly work for the very rich and the corporation. And I say this to say, as we respond to George Floyd's murder, as we respond to the contemporary violence, we need to be crystal clear. This violence is being funded and promoted by the government's violence. Is ultimately attributable to politicians like Donald Trump. It's ultimately attributable to actors like the Koch brothers or the Mercers who fund racial resentment as a way for them to win power. And what that means is that it's so important that people protesting this violence do so in a way that's multiracial and that builds solidarity across race lines. Because racism is wrong, and every race needs to stand up and say that. And because racial division is the weapon of the rich that built this violent system in the first place. And finally, because racial division is the weapon of the rich that is being used against us for every issue in our society, the lack of response to the pandemic, the massive transfer of trillions of dollars to corporations, the tax cuts that Trump passed, all of those depend upon a message of racial fear and resentment that ultimately is embroiled in the criminal justice system and in Trump's continued efforts to stoke resentment against people who are protesting racism and dehumanization.
Hmm. So one of the questions then is, how could this moment create a solidarity movement across class and race? Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be joined by August Nimps, and he wrote a piece for the Minnesota Post called "It's a Big Deal That the Outrage Expressed Over George Floyd's Death Was Massive and Multiracial."
That's so important. I think that at a moment like this, the first most important impulse to bring people together in a multiracial movement is the moral one. we, you know, 2020 is different from 1970 when Richard Nixon was running on these themes. 2020, we can watch that damn video. We can see the inhumanity of it. We can see the brutality of it. And it's not just that video. So many videos, so many names. But in addition, I think that the racial sensibility of most Americans has really shifted. Barack Obama, the Obama family, they're adored and beloved by millions of people. And so there's this basic moral impulse to say, my God, we're all human, and we can see the brutal inhumanity of that murder. So I think that that's the first impulse to bring people together is in a multiracial movement, to recognize that all lives matter precisely when all lives matter, including black lives and brown lives, and Muslims and Asian Americans and Native Americans. That's the first impulse. But in addition, we need to develop and promote a clear recognition of the dynamic that Robert mentioned. Some of the most powerful, cynical elements of our society are trying to take advantage of promoting racial hatred and racial conflict. The Republican Party settled on this as their principal way to win political power 50 years ago. And that's what they've been doing ever since, and they're doing it so clearly in 2020. They are backed by major family dynasties like the Koch brothers, like the Mercers. They are backed by major corporations who fund think tanks that promote these sorts of racial resentments. They are backed by a right-wing media ecosystem, Fox News, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, whose basic business model is to stir racial hatred and conflict in order to convince people to support politicians who mainly answer to or are themselves members of the billionaires' class. And the more we see that racism against black and brown people is a weapon that's being used against white people too, the more we can create a multiracial movement in which everybody understands that when you protest, frankly, when you organize and vote, you're doing so to fight racism against people of color in order to take care of your own family. Whether you're a person of color or a white person, fighting racism against people of color is the most important thing any of us can do to take care of our own families, because racism is brutalizing our society and it's being used as a divide and conquer weapon against all of us.
Ian Haney Lopez holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. His most recent book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. Robert, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go next to Thomas in San Francisco. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, let me turn my radio down here. I want to pose my question first and then speak to the police riots this weekend. I'm calling from the perspective of like an old commie who basically who would like to wave away a little bit of the smoke of the narrative here. But my question first is that I would like in your coming week, because we count on you, Rose. I mean, you're the furthest thing left we've got on KALW, which has swung massively to the right over the years. I would like to know, I would like you to broadcast legal defense funds, who basically are going to be white folks, older white folks who can't run anymore in front of a phalanx of rioting police, and who can't, you know, like lob tear gas canisters back at cops and things like that. And frankly, as a white person, have no business doing so, because this is basically, we're not dog whistling in this country anymore. This is basically an open call to the radical right to you know, to rise up, and we're seeing that at some of these events. But I would like to know if the Lawyers Guild and other left-wing organizations are going to do pro bono defense work, and I'd like to know how to donate to them. And that can happen anytime this week. But what I'm concerned about is that this this narrative has been exclusively about the Republican Party, and it's really important to sort of take the blinders off and see what we've got in a Democratic Party that worked harder to disenfranchise and to basically kneecap the Bernie Sanders movement. It worked much harder at that than it ever, you know, did against any kind of Mick resistance against Trump. So what we've got is we've got a very troubled troubled man who basically is got the coronation from the other corporate party, who has a really, really horrendous segregationist past. He basically allied with Louise Day Hicks during the race riots in Boston during the 70s, and basically dog whistled his way into, you know, like a political career. Joe Biden is basically, we've got a corporate party that is basically eagerly and enthusiastically campaigned for a couple of, you know, of scraps to be thrown, but it basically put into place the largest transfer, upward transfer of wealth in the history of this country in place, and they're still doing it. So I would...
Thank you for calling in, Thomas. Ian, there's so much there, but you mentioned Bill Clinton, but Joe Biden helped write the 1994 crime law. There's a lot to unpack there. And, you know, a lot of people are just saying, where are the Democrats right now? But first off, just talk about Joe Biden's record on these issues. And yeah.
I think the caller, I think he's, I think Thomas is completely right. I think we need to put it into a larger context. Democrats understand immediately in 1970 that the Republicans are going to use race as a wedge issue against them. They're trying to figure out what they do. Their first intuition is that they need to walk away from people of color, that if the Republicans are going to say Democrats care more about communities of color than they do about the white working class, Democrats can prove that's false by starting to ignore African Americans and other communities of color. That doesn't work, and so we get to Bill Clinton, who says, well, if we can't just run silent and ignore them, we should imitate them. And so Bill Clinton picks up on Republican dog whistles. He promises to end welfare as a way of life. He promises to crack down on crime. You know, whose way of life was welfare, and who are the supposed criminals? These were Republican themes. And what we see from the 1990s onwards is that Democrats end up in an upward bidding war with Republicans to see who could convey to whites that they would do the most to punish communities of color, to strip them of government assistance, to defund their schools, but also to fund policing and fund prisons. And now, one other comment. As Democrats walk away from communities of color, they also walk away from the labor movement, labor and civil rights. It's a complicated history, but you can't walk away from one without walking away from the other. And after they do that, they have to say to themselves, and this is, again, the Clinton era, if our main source of strength isn't going to be communities of color or labor, what will it be? And the Democrats themselves begin lobbying for support from Wall Street. And so what we have now is a Democratic Party that has grown comfortable with the idea that it is, that its success depends upon keeping distance from communities of color, making comfortable racially resentful whites, and generating most of their campaign contributions from Wall Street. And I think that was the model that Bernie Sanders interrupted in 2016, and he showed that model was just wrong, not wrong simply on a moral basis, not wrong simply on a policy basis. It's wrong on those levels too, but wrong also in terms of where the base of progressives have shifted. Base of progressives are willing to fund a candidate who stands up against corporate interests. They're willing to fund a candidate who takes strong positions in favor of racial justice. And I think we're in a situation now in which progressives need to look not simply at 2020, when frankly we must elect Joe Biden, but we need to look beyond Biden as well and to say, part of what we're trying to do is reclaim the Democratic Party itself, return the Democratic Party to a party that believes in working families and that believes in civil rights and that understands that supporting labor and supporting civil rights, supporting racial equality are inseparable, and that delivering on those promises are the way you actually build a supermajority of voters. In today's country, that supermajority must be multiracial. There is no supermajority that is not multiracial. And the only way you build a supermajority that is multiracial and that takes care of working class families is to address racial division head on, but also to see that racial division and class inequality are flip sides of the same coin for all of us, for white families too. White families need to recognize that racial division is precisely the main weapon that the rich have been wielding in the class war they have been winning for the last 50 years. A multiracial, progressive, working class movement is the only way forward for all of our families.
Well, thank you for the call, Thomas. We're almost out of time, and I want to make sure we get to everyone else, but we're going to definitely do an entire hour on this particular issue because it is so incredibly important. Where, you know, when you look at the corporate wing of the Democratic Party and what happened with Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, you know, where does this leave us? Under COVID, less than 6 months to the election, you've got some states ruling that people cannot use mail in ballots. We're going to do a show about that. But where does this leave people? But let's take a few more calls because people have been waiting patiently. Let's go to Greg. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
I'm not sure I can add much to what has already been said, but I'll just make 3 points, I guess. One is that yesterday I tried to go on the Internet briefly to check out police killings in the United States. And not that this is a surprise to anybody, but since 2017, police killings of everybody across the board, white, black, Hispanic, Native people, averaging between 800 and 1,000 people a year, almost three people a day getting killed by the police. The second thing is that, and you touched about this at the national level, at the local level in Minneapolis, this cop who murdered Floyd and the other police who were there, they did this because they knew, or they thought they knew, that they weren't going to get be held responsible for this. There's no other way that you can think about this, and you can see how this was handled in Minneapolis, that the establishment there didn't do anything until there was unrest and people were demanding that something be done, and they only charged this guy with third-degree murder, and the other people have not been charged yet. So this DA in Minneapolis represents the establishment. I mean, that's why they didn't do anything. And lastly, just want to say one thing that's been brought up. The violence against the poor in this country is just remarkable. It's not just people getting killed. Every day, poor people in this country have to deal with violence. And it's you know, I don't know the answer to what's going to change this, but clearly this country's in serious trouble. And I don't know if, you know, if Biden gets elected, I'm not keeping my fingers crossed that he's going to do anything to address this significantly. So the only way that people could do it if he gets elected is just to stay on his back every day of the week and just demand that something be done.
Well, thank you, Greg. And to that point, and Ian, we have just about a minute left. Sue writes in, something must be done and as soon as possible, but what and how? Aside from voting, what can we as individuals do to make this happen?
I think the most important thing that we can do right now is build the racial solidarity that the right for the last 50 years has expended everything they can to destroy, and that, frankly, the left has largely ignored. We walked away from the idea that we have to recognize each other's humanity across race lines. That is the single most important thing for us to do. It's important so that we can take care of each other, so that we can fight the terrible immorality, the brutality of the racism we're seeing. But it's important also so that we can build the political power that in a democracy either resides with the people or resides with concentrated wealth. And the tactic of concentrated wealth for the last 50 years has been to divide us on many different lines, gender and religion, immigrant versus citizen, but more than anything else, to divide us in terms of race. We have to build a sense of cross-racial solidarity. We need to recognize that racism is real, recognize that division is real, and recognize that we must do the hard work of building alliances and human connections across those lines. That's the only way we honor and respond to these murders. That is the only way that we build enough political power to take care of our own families.
Well, we need to continue to have these conversations through Election Day. Ian, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ian Haney Lopez holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. His most recent book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. And all week, we are going to be talking about this massive uprising to demand justice for George Floyd and to speak out against police brutality, economic inequality, and so many other issues. If you have any show ideas or guest ideas, please email us yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.